Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksicles? I don't know. How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Today on the show, Steven Van Zandt, little Steven, is on the show, the guitar player for the E Street Band, also an actor, played Syl on The Sopranos. He's also he has his first solo album out as little Steven in nearly two decades called Soul Fire. You can get that. It's bands on the road. But it's exciting, man. Steven Van Zandt here in the garage with his bandana on. Arrived in sandals. He was wearing long jeans and flip-flops, in my recollection. Flip-flops. I was a little nervous to talk to him. A little bit nervous. But, after the first few minutes, I think we got into a groove. We got into a thing. We worked it out. What's happening with you? You all right? Everything okay? How's work? You doing all right? The house, how's everything with the home life? Okay? How the kids? All right? How's the boyfriend? How's the girlfriend? How's the husband? How's the wife? Everything good? How's your mom and dad? Everything all right? Holding up? No? Yes? No? Sorry. You're going to be okay? You'll be okay, right? God damn, man. I am back at it, running around, as you know, some of you, from house to house. Not going door to door, but I'm recording here in this garage until I get my recording situation tight, the other joint. And it's kind of weird. I'm appreciating things more. It's strange when you sort of move things out of a house. It takes on a different smell. I guess when there's not cats actively shitting in it, three of them, all times of the day and night, it takes on a different smell. Surprising, huh? That when your house isn't filled with shitting cats and pissing cats, how it changes the aroma of the home. I've been making myself do the comedy. You know, it doesn't take, you know, I don't have to force myself, but you know, I need the outlet, man. I fucking need the outlet. I need to work shit out. You know what I mean? It's just, that's where I work shit out. Yeah, I've been out there doing the work. Because there's a lot of stuff going on in my heart and my mind. And I got to, you know, sometimes I pull back from the stand-up, but then I realize, like, well, who am I going to talk to this stuff about if it isn't a room full of strangers? If I don't get on stage, I literally begin to lose my mind in what seems to be a very real way. I sort of become isolated inside my own head, and I don't, like there's always this emotional storm sort of brewing up inside my brain and inside my heart, and I'm unable to communicate it in any, you know, normal way to other people. And, you know, I'm constantly absorbing things and just feeding that storm, feeding that fire. And it's just, there's never anything passive in my brain. Like if I'm not talking or I'm like, you know, or I seem distracted, I'm just shut the fuck down. There's nothing passive. I mean, some things are not on the daily docket and some things I just don't know about. But there is an agenda up there in my head and it requires vigilance to manage because it is not always a pro-Mark agenda. And I need to be on stage to make sense of my world, you know, which is just a fucking mixture of my perception of myself and the parts of the external world that compounding into my mind and in my eyes at all times. I mean, look, relaxing would be nice. It would be nice. But I just have this this calling in my, I don't know if it's a calling, but I find myself saying, like, I just got to figure this out. I just got to figure shit out. I just got to figure it out. But maybe that's just a bad habit, because I'm guessing I'm not ever going to figure it out. I should just stop trying. But I can't. So there's stand-up. That's the process. And, you know, I made a little headway on some new bits the other night. Got me excited. I always think that there's not going to be any more bits after I dump an hour plus out into the world on a special. But then it starts. It just starts. I get excited about one thing, and it just starts to bleed out and spread. And there's a freedom of mind that starts to happen. And that's sort of the, that's kind of the wildfire that I need. You know, the ones that are out in the real world, which are terrifying and destructive, I'd rather have the wildfires in my brain. You know, that's fine. That's fine. It's usually about 70% controlled. And generally fueled by discomfort and discontent. I mean, and I've talked about this before. I think many of the reasons I feel those things have eased. But fortunately, or not, there's a bit at the core, a bit of discontent and discomfort at the core that will never ease up until I let go one way or the other. Right? You can feel that. You could have like a peace of mind if you just surrender a bit. Let go. Let go. Let go. You hear about that, you know? Let go. But I got to be honest with you, I do not, I don't know. I am not really trying to let go, which should really be the goal, but I don't know what I would be if I did let go. And clearly the fear of that guy is bigger than just being the anxious, dread-filled freak that I am most of the time. Just stoking that fire, 70% controlled in my brain. My mental wildfire, 70% controlled. Always trying to fucking get it. Not, you know, I don't want it out. So I'm just sort of managing it. Managing it. Then like new stuff grows behind it in a year or so. You know, once it's done, once it stops. Yeah, but never stops fully. Stand up. Stand up is the treatment, the relief, the reaching out. I mean, I must assume all of us have that a bit at the core, that discontent, that unanswerable stuff, that itch. Yeah, I mean, everybody has that, right? We all sort of know it's a ripoff, right? This whole thing, right? A joke that we know the end of, right? We know the punchline. We know that final turn of phrase, don't we? All right, so it's Christmas. Maybe you should go by Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By from the WTF podcast for your friends, relatives, and family. You know what I mean? Get it where you get books. So Little Steven is here. And as I said earlier, his first solo album is out in it's nearly two decades. It's called Soul Fire. And it's a soulful record. It's R&B record, man. It's good. Big band. It's a big band. And it's cranking, man. And you can also see him with his band, The Disciples of Soul, in Brooklyn and Red Bank, New Jersey, this week. Go to littlesteven.com for tickets. And he just released a cover of the Ramones' Merry Christmas, I Don't Want to Fight Tonight. You can get that as a digital single. This is me and Little Steven talking. So when you're touring, like, does it wear you out? I mean, Jesus, you're a little older than me. Do you get tired?
No, I mean, you're kind of like always tired. You know what I mean? Like,
that's right. Yeah.
You know, I don't get jet lag because I'm always jet lagged. You know what I mean? It's like, doesn't really affect you that much. You know?
You get into that zone where you're just sort of half awake all the time.
Yeah.
Then it's time to play.
My whole life. You just described my whole life.
It's wild, but I guess, you know, what else you can do? How do you handle free time well at all? Can you do it?
No, I don't really have any. You know, when you're a writer,
yeah.
You know, of any kind, I think.
Yeah.
You never have any free time, you know?
Yeah, that's true. But, like, are you able to sit down maybe on a boat or, you know, at home or in another country or on an island, anything?
No.
No, you can't do it?
No, I had a vacation once, 1978, and I didn't like it.
That was
I didn't get it.
Where'd you go? Maybe that had something to do with it.
My wife got me tickets to the Super Bowl, you know, in Miami, which is nice, you know.
Sure. Are you a Miami guy?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I've always wanted a house, you know, on the water somewhere, you know, and I never have done it, you know. So It's like one of my fantasies. I'm keeping it alive.
Yeah, you might want to bite a little inland now. The water's creeping up.
Well, that's one problem. This hurricane thing also is kind of like, you know.
Yeah,
so I'm looking more like, you know, Mediterranean. You know, something like a little calmer. Yeah, you know,
get out there. Yeah, maybe off the coast of Italy somewhere.
Exactly, but it's just a fantasy. I'm never gonna probably do. But
that's interesting that you know, I have those fantasies and. But I believe that you have a bit more revenue than I do. So you would think that buying a house.
Don't be so sure. I can do a lot of things. I get, you know, making money and holding on to it is not one of my things, man.
You can make it, but you can't hold on to it.
I mean, you know, who else travels with a 15-piece band?
Yeah, right.
I got 30 people on the road. I'm playing clubs. Okay.
Yeah.
You understand? I got an arena show in clubs right now.
For the love of the craft, for the love of the music.
It's an expensive hobby, okay? Let me just explain that to you right now.
The record sounds fucking great, though.
Thank you, man. Thank you. Yeah.
I did two things today that I never did before. I listened to your new record, and I listened to Hearts of Stone, which you produce, right?
Yep.
And like I was never like a Southside Johnny guy, and I hadn't listened to him in a long time. Huh. And I just put it on, and I'm like, you know, the theme of the sound that you are part of, that I have to assume that you helped invent, runs all the way through it, and it seems to go all the way back to like Stax and to, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Yep.
Because this new record, it's a real like soul record. It's a real R&B record.
Yeah.
Full force.
Yeah, yeah. I just decided, you know, let me go back to what I'm most known for, you know, what I'm most uniquely known for in terms of my identity, which is that rock meets soul thing, you know, that we created with Southside,
right?
On those three albums, and then also did a reunion record in the 90s, which is probably the best of them all.
The reunion with Southside,
yeah, called Better Days. If you get a chance to hear that one.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that's probably the best one of them all. And then I carried it into my first solo album. And then all five of my solo albums were completely different musical genres. Every single one of them, I just changed completely because it was all about the politics back then for me.
Right.
And the music kind of came second in a sense of complementing whatever I was saying, you know. So I wasn't worried about consistency or career or anything like that, which was quite naive looking back on it, of course. But it was just an artistic adventure for me. I wasn't looking at it like a career, like a business.
Right,
like,
but you're also delivering the message.
It's all about the message.
Then. Yeah, yeah.
So this is the first time, and it was because of the political atmosphere, how different it was in the 80s than now. Very, very different political atmosphere, and so it was... I felt, you know,
different.
Back,
it's pretty bad now.
Well, I mean, the lyrics of the songs hold up shockingly well.
From the 80s.
Yes. Which is good and bad, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
But the atmosphere back then was I felt obligated to be, you know, to shine some light on things that were kind of hidden, and people thinking Ronald Reagan was God, and I really didn't. And there's a lot of bad things going on around the world, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And I felt like, you know, somebody needs to, like, start talking about this stuff in a bigger way. And so, back then you're looking for your justification for existence, you know what I mean? Like, did the world really need another, you know, romantic album of love songs from a sideman? You know what I mean? I didn't think so. Let me find something that's unique. So I'll be the political guy, you know.
And that was like what, for Voice of America?
All of them, all five, yeah. Really. And plus Sun City,
right. Sun City, I remember Sun City. Yeah. I was very excited about Sun City.
Yeah, it was very, very successful, and
it made a difference. I think
made a difference. Brought down the government.
Yeah,
if you call that making a difference, a Mandela out of jail. Yeah, we did some good things back then. But it was again a lot of that stuff was like behind, you know, it was hidden, you know, all that bad stuff we were supporting around the world. I got no reason to explain Donald Trump. I mean, you know, he explains himself very well every single day, and I find that liberating in a funny kind of odd way. I feel like, wow, I can make a record now that's not political without feeling guilty.
Right, because by default, this is the most transparent administration we've ever had because he can't shut up.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah. Thank God he has that quality of like just complete, you know, it's an odd kind of it's kind of a paradox because nothing he says is true.
Yeah,
but everything he says is weirdly honest. And at the same time, it's like his true feelings are quite obvious. But he's even though everything he's saying is probably
and
a lie.
And also as an East Coast guy, you're familiar with the character.
Very, and he's really simple to understand. It's just all about the money. And if you understand that.
You know,
it solves a lot of the problems, in terms of trying to understand
motivations
and things like that. Just think of it as all about the money, which probably will keep us out of World War III.
Maybe.
Because that's going to, unless he finds a way to profit from it,
But now he's the front man for a band of fucking craven, fascist and religious fanatics.
This is the point.
Yeah.
Now you're on to the point.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
This is the danger right now we're facing is not Donald Trump. I think he's just a massive distraction from the real problem, which is the Republican Party,
It's dismantling the whole thing.
Well, I'm just, my attitude is like, we need to save the Republican Party, okay? This is my attitude, all right?
As a Republican?
No, as an independent.
Yeah.
I feel, since we can't get a third party together in this country,
which
is sad, all right? We really do need one, but we're probably not going to get it. So we need at least two.
Yeah,
all right?
Yeah.
And we need two that can have a reasonable discourse, right? That have, intelligent and, calm and like reasonable people who can, who can reason with each other, right?
Sure.
And my father was a Goldwater Republican.
Okay? Yeah.
Ex-Marine, Goldwater Republican.
You grew up with that.
Yes. I was the generation gap.
Yeah.
Me and him. And I look back to that and I'm like, he would not recognize the party at all.
Sure.
The true Goldwater Republicans are like more like libertarians, of course. They're not, religious and forcing their religion on people and all that.
We still got those guys around, but now there's a whole new breed of like, I don't give a fuck about anything Republicans.
Well, yeah, but it's religious based.
Some of them,
because now, it's only two issues really. And when it comes down to it, it's only two issues where they're completely irrational on the one hand and un-American on the other issue, which is the environment, which. I've never understood how the environment became a Democratic issue. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Isn't it all the
survival
same
of the planet?
What pisses me off is these nice little terms, global warming and climate change. I'm like, why can't we just call it poison? Can we just call it poison? pollution? Let's not stop confusing people.
You're poisoning the ship we're living on.
Yeah, like it's poison. Yeah. You understand? How are you in favor of poison? I don't quite get that. So that's just the irrational part of the Republican Party. And then the other issue is just equality.
Yeah.
That's completely anti-American, un-American to not believe in equality, whether it's for women or for gays or whatever it may be. And that's
race, everything.
But that's all based on religion, in my mind.
But like Goldwater Republic, that's interesting. So you grew up in Jersey though, right?
Yep.
So when you were a kid, were you always going at it with your old man?
Yeah. I'm telling you, we were the generation gap that people talk about. We were the exact opposites for a while there till they threw me out of the house.
Were you born in Jersey, though?
I was born in Boston.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. For 7 years.
And okay, you don't really remember that?
Not much. No, I don't remember. I remember my grandfather taking me to the Italian section.
Oh, yeah,
town.
The North End?
But anyway, that's all I remember. But my mother remarried and
the
Dutchman adopted me and got me the Dutch name.
So that's who you see as your father?
Yeah, I never knew my original father. But I'm 100% Italian.
Did he pass or did?
He many years ago. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So never knew him. Never met him again.
But he was alive during your childhood. You just never sought him out.
Right.
Oh. Yeah. Well, that's. You feel all right about that?
Yeah. I'm like the guy who adopted me. That was the ballsy move. And those in the 50s, man. To marry a woman with a kid. And,
did he have kids?
Well, there are two more after me.
Oh, really?
I got a brother and sister. Yeah.
Yeah. Wild. Good guy.
But very conservative, ex-Marine, Goldwater Republican in every sense of the word.
So when did you get thrown out of the house?
Same time I got thrown out of school last year. Last year of high school.
And what year was that? So the country must have been coming apart.
67, 68.
How'd you avoid the draft?
Well, I went down. I got drafted and went down there and had a long talk with the guy. And I'm like, so explain this to me again.
The long talk. Because
I don't get it.
Yeah.
Just explain to me. Yeah. If you can explain to me why I'm going, you know, 10,000 miles away to kill somebody.
Yeah.
I'll do it. I'm, you know, I got no problem killing people. You know, if that's the issue,
if it has to be done,
you know. Well, I mean, when they, you know, at, you know, they when they land on, you know, when they land on in Belmar here, I'll be the first one down there with a gun. I mean, you know, that's
Belmar.
But you know, until they're attacking, you know, Seabright.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
The boardwalk.
Know? So yeah,
the boardwalk.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So just explain it to me, you know. And he starts telling me about communism. You know. I'm like, all right, stop right there. What's communism?
Yeah.
Exactly. He couldn't even begin to explain what that was.
Uh-huh.
You know, well, it's, you know,
so
it's dictatorship, kind of. Uh-huh. And I'm like, well, all right. You know, and I didn't even know about the history at that point. So in the end, you know, we had this conversation, and I'm like, you know, this ain't for me, babe. You know?
And he said, okay, right. Thanks for dropping by.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, he says, fill out this column A, column B. He says, check that whole column B.
Which is like psychiatric, conscientious objector.
Psycho, drug addict, homosexual.
He just went through the whole menu.
Yeah. I said, I'll be all those things. You know, but, you know.
Well, that was that early on? I mean, it's
nothing personal.
It's surprising that they let you do that.
Well, you know, I don't think they were looking to put people in jail exactly, you know.
Yeah.
If you really felt strongly about it, I don't think they really cared, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they made an example, you know, out of Muhammad Ali, you know, which was a tragedy.
When did you start playing?
Just a year before the Beatles hit, you know. My grandfather started teaching me the guitar.
Like 60?
I was 12 or so, which was 63.
Your grandfather?
My Italian, my mother's father, taught me the song from his town in Calabria.
Oh, yeah.
Every town had a theme song. Yeah. And so I started learning that, and then, of course, February 9th is the Big Bang, you know, 1964.
For everybody your generation, man, that night was it.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
The Big Bang of rock and roll, man, you know. And for some people, a little older, the Big Bang was the same TV show, 8 years earlier, right?
Yeah.
You know, when
but
Elvis.
It's wild, though, when you think about it, and I know you do think about it because you're in it all the time, is that, you know, rock and roll as a form is not that old. Yeah, but what, 57, 50? What do you think was the first rock song? Rocket 88 or Rock Around the Clock?
We talk about that stuff, yeah. I mean, you could say that. I mean, certainly Rock Around the Clock was the first big success.
Yeah.
You know, that was the first number one rock and roll record.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, on its second release.
Sure.
As its as a theme song to the movie Black Boy Jungle. That kind of opened the door.
Yeah.
And then soon after, Elvis had the number one Jailhouse... with Heartbreak Hotel, you know.
That was right after.
Yeah, it was right after.
Yeah.
And so that was a 1-2 punch that really said, you know, here we come. You know, here comes this cult. This cult is about to stage a coup on the charts. Okay?
Yeah.
And it slowly, you know, started to take over because rock and roll was not pop music yet. It was still a cult, you know, and really up until, you know, it started to in the 50s. I mean, the brave white DJs like Alan Freed, you know, started playing these black records for white kids, you know.
For a little money.
Change
a little money
world.
On the side.
Hey, baby, yeah. I pay up. That's money well spent, all right?
Yeah.
Money well spent.
Yeah.
You know, and he took the money after he played the record, not before. Yeah. All right, which, you know, I wish somebody would do for me, but that's another story. You know, so it was not payola, per se.
Right.
All right, it was gratitude.
Yeah, thank you very much. Here's a little something.
That's right.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
That's right.
In my mind.
So, what do you need? I got a few bucks.
It started, you could say Rocket 88, you could say how many more years from Howlin' Wolf. You could, you know, both of which were produced by Sam Phillips, that unbelievable genius. For me, Lieber and Stoller were the beginning of the modern, you know, songwriter producers.
Yeah.
And they began to have that bigger sound. They brought strings in. Phil Spector, of course, would have that big sound with horns, but not featuring the horns so much. But they would be part of that big, you know, 50-piece band.
Yeah.
So the real, you know, what I related to earliest on was Motown. You know, Motown was really the first to start combining strings and horns and background vocals. And to me, the Motown model is what I'm using now, yeah. You know, pretty much.
Yeah.
But you had the Four Seasons also making big records. So the big records were Lieber and Stoller, Phil Spector, Motown, Curtis Mayfield later.
No, the Mayfield. You do a song on there that's a little Curtis Mayfield, a little Isaac Hayes.
Yeah.
On the new
but
record.
But also Alan Toussaint out of New Orleans too.
So,
you know, you get that combination of Memphis,
yeah.
and you know, and Atlantic.
Isn't that interesting that, like, as a guy who grows and becomes sort of a student of all this stuff, that still at the beginning, the thing that delivered the message was the Beatles. And then you had to go back and get this stuff, I imagine.
Oh, I never heard of any of this stuff. Right. I never heard of Chuck Berry.
Right?
I'm telling you right now. I never heard of Muddy Waters. I never heard of Bo Diddley. I never heard of these people. The only reason I knew Elvis Presley's name was because my grandmother used to buy his records and dance around in the living room.
It's wild, right?
I'm like, who's that, Nana? That's Elvis Presley. You know, that's all I heard.
So when you started playing, what were you playing?
Well, right after the Italian folk song, I went right to it was the Beatles, you know, that first. When the Beatles hit February 9th, 1964, keep in mind, we got introduced to the Beatles halfway through the career.
Yeah.
Okay? They had been going since 58. They were gone in 69. So we met them halfway through the career. So they were quite sophisticated. They were sophisticated beyond what we could relate to in a direct way, but they opened up a new world to us. It's like, wow.
With that first record or the second record?
Record. Well, I mean, we got the second record thinking it was the first.
Yeah.
All right, the Meet the Beatles was actually with the Beatles, which is actually their second album.
Yeah.
But we got it first.
Right.
Which was twice as remarkable because of the composition level at that point.
It's kind
of
crazy, already, when you think about it.
Yeah. But they were too perfect. The harmony was perfect, their hair was perfect, the clothes were perfect. It was here is another world, which was the most important thing. Yeah. There was another world that was out there that we could now fantasize
about. The aliens have arrived.
Especially when you're a misfit
in Jersey,
freak, not fitting in anywhere, right?
Were you?
Wait a minute, maybe there's hope.
Were you uncomfortable with you didn't fit in?
Oh no, I couldn't relate to anything. Nothing. Nothing.
Zero.
I was like an alien from another planet waiting for my ship to arrive, get me back to my planet, baby.
Where's my agenda?
And here it comes, right? That spaceship landed in Central Park and the Beatles came out, right?
Yeah.
But they were too good, And then Dave Clark 5, same thing, really, really good. But luckily 4 months later, the Rolling Stones came. Okay.
Oh, the Stones.
Which just changed everything.
A little dirty, a little loose.
And they didn't have the harmony, they're a little sloppy. And
blues,
the
blues.
Clothes were different. And most importantly, the moment that changed my life for real.
There's
the second, another moment that changed my life was seeing Mick Jagger for the first time. He was the first guy in show business that I had ever seen who did not smile.
He did.
Okay?
Yeah.
I never seen that before.
Is that true?
That's true. If you look at all the show business people up till then, right?
Yeah.
They were all, having a good time and kind of
entertaining.
Entertaining.
Yeah.
It was show business.
Sure.
Well, him not smiling to me was okay. This is a lifestyle. This is not show business.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Right.
And that's what I really related to. I was like, "Oh, okay. That's where I belong."
Right. Because the Beatles with the matching outfits, that was still show business.
Yes.
And clearly very polished. That was show business because that goes back a bit. The matching outfits, they were white guys doing it, right?
So then
the Stones come out. It's like, hey, what's with the scarf? Where'd that guy get those boots? Why is that guy unhappy? Hey, this is a way of life.
That's right. Big difference.
Yeah.
Okay. And to me, that was it. And so, of course, they made it look easier than it was. I mean, they were also fantastic, which.
But early on, like, what could you notice that difference? Because what would you say the difference was between the Beatles and the Stones? Essentially,
the Beatles were a pop vocal oriented group, and the Stones were a blues instrumental oriented group,
right?
They had instrumentals on their records, right away.
Yeah, so right.
What was that? That was weird.
Right on that first album, boom.
Yeah, so 2120 South Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, that's right.
Now I Got a Witness. I think they had two instrumentals that maybe
on the on presenting.
Maybe one of them was on 12x5, but they were doing instrumentals right away. you know, both Mick and Brian were playing harmonica, and you know.
Did you listen to that new one, the new Stones Blues record?
Yeah.
He's back on the harmonica, and it sounds good, man.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good.
It's wild. It's
good, you know.
Yeah.
I wish he spent a little more time on it, but you know. You know, come on, Mick.
Yeah.
You are good at this. Yeah. You know.
Couple more days.
Get great. Yeah. You know what I mean? He needs somebody encouraging him to take it to that next level, you know?
Yeah.
But as a record, of course, it was a wonderful.
Well, maybe Mick will get it. Maybe he'll get it.
It's a great idea. Well, he was good, but, you know, Brian was better, you know.
On the harp.
Yeah. And, you know, and Mick, I think he could be good if he actually applied himself
to it. No, I think, because he can single out the notes. You know, he's got a feel for it.
Yeah. No, there's some good harp playing, but it should be great at this point, which it could be.
Yeah, I think he puts it down for a decade or two.
Exactly. You could tell, you know, it's like, okay, he's kind of getting back into it, but, you know, come on, you know, Mick. Let's work a little harder here. Come on. You know,
a little something.
You guys are like still the greatest thing. And that was the most successful record, I think, in decades for them, which is great.
It was a pretty exciting record somehow.
It brought them back to the roots, which is great.
Right. Could have been their first record. That lineup of songs could have been their first record.
It was great. It was a great idea, and I'm glad they pulled it off. So,
what was your first band?
I joined a band, a local band called The Shadows.
In Jersey.
In Jersey as a singer.
Yeah.
And then shortly after, that was 65, and by 66, I had my own band called The Source. I had stolen a name from a group in New York. You know, I used to go up to Greenwich Village on the weekends at the Cafe Wa and see groups in the afternoon.
Late 60s?
This is, 66, 67.
Oh, yeah? Who'd you see?
Well, I just missed Jimi Hendrix. He was just there.
And then he went to England.
Yeah, I just missed him. But... I saw the only notable name really was in that group, The Source.
Yeah,
I took the name from was a guy named John Hall, who would later become a congressman.
Oh yeah,
that's your
big rock and roll in the late 60s story.
It, man. And he was phenomenal back then. He was a genius, really a musical genius. And he became a congressman.
Really?
Yeah. He got voted out at the moment in the bloodbath of a few years ago.
The Source, that was the name of the band?
That was my so I took that name, and that was my first real band.
What were you playing?
I was playing guitar, lead guitar,
songs?
And
were you
singing.
Original shit?
Oh, no. No, we were doing album tracks. We were doing some top 40. Like, we would do some Temptations and... some hits at the time, but we were also doing tracks from The Who's first album and The Young Bloods and Buffalo Springfield, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So by 67, 68, you know, the FM radio had started and the album thing had started, so we're kind of combining some of the hits on radio, on AM radio, with some of the FM stuff, you know.
When did you start writing?
I started writing right away. And didn't really like anything I wrote for 7 years. Okay, literally. I was writing and just throwing them away and like just wasn't getting anywhere.
And you were playing all down the shore mostly?
Yeah, it was a wonderful time to grow up. Wonderful time. We had all kinds of places to play. We had the high school dances. We had the VFW halls. We had the beach clubs. You know,
what town were you? Where did you grow up?
Middletown. But it was whatever it was, 20 minutes from the ocean. You know, so you know, it was just a wonderful. Our generation was very lucky that way. We had actual teenage nightclubs.
Sure.
Latin Devu was one of them.
What was your first electric guitar?
I had an Epiphone, and then I traded in for a Telecaster. You know?
So you're a Tele guy.
Yeah, and one day, you know, and me and Bruce had become friends, and we actually became even closer friends by running into each other in Greenwich Village on the weekends. You know, he was doing the same thing I was
in the late '60s.
Yeah, seeing the bands there who were a year ahead of New Jersey.
Yeah,
so we would pick up things and go back and make our bands.
So you ran into him there too.
Yeah, so we became even closer friends at that point.
But you just knew him from the block, kind of
from
thing?
The circuit.
Yeah, he was in a band. You were in a band.
Everybody, there were no bands in America February 8th.
Yeah.
The Beatles played February 9th. February 10th, everybody had a band, all right? it was like that. Mostly in the garage, right? Rehearsing.
Yeah.
Well, maybe a dozen groups in our area came out of the garage and actually played. So you knew them all. And his was one of them, and mine was one of them.
What was his called?
He had the Castiles.
Oh.
I had the Source, you know.
And he was singing and playing?
Yeah, yeah, we were both
front men.
Well, actually, yeah, but he had a couple other singers also in the band as
well. I think you mentioned that. Yeah. Yeah,
but you know, I was the main singer for me,
right?
For, in my lead guitar and arranger and you know, basic,
yeah,
leader. You know,
so you got the Source, he's got the Castiles, and you see each other around. Then you run into him in New York.
Yeah,
and on a weekend.
So we became even closer from that. But
did you talk about music right away?
Yeah, that's all we talked about.
Yeah,
that's it. We were both.
Was he a Telecaster guy then too?
Well, no. This is the point. So at some point he came to me, says, you know, I'm thinking about switching. You know, can I switch to the Telecaster? He asked my permission. You know, because you couldn't. You were your guitar in those days, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was the Tele guy.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So he asked my permission to become a Tele guy. You know.
In the neighborhood.
And so I said, "All right, I'll switch to something else. I'll switch to Stratocaster."
Oh, you had to switch.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Everybody had their guitar, their sound, their thing. You know.
Uh huh.
And yeah.
So he switched to. He went to Tele. He stuck with it.
He stuck with it.
He's a Tele guy.
Yeah, man, all the way.
So when did you guys start playing together?
Right after that, we started, you know, we'd be in a different band every 3 months, 4 months.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'd play in my band, sometimes I'd play in his band.
Yeah.
And we started playing together right then, 68, 69.
What was that first band called, your band? Didn't you guys do a hard rock band together? Or was he in a hard rock band?
Well, yeah, he started, Steel Mill.
Steel Mill,
was,
right.
It was like, hard-ish. I mean, it was hard for then, but...
were you in that one?
It was more, yeah, I played bass in that band. And I had the Sundance Blues Band.
And he
played rhythm in that for a while.
And these were bands that played gigs, all these different bands.
Yeah, yeah.
Sundance Blues Band, was it a blues band?
Yeah.
Straight up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Southside Johnny in that one. And, we're just finding our way, you know what I mean? You go through different phases. Had a country band for a while.
Did you? What was that called?
Oh, geez, something stupid, you know, because some other guy that was the main guy.
Yeah.
Albie something.
Yeah. What was the name of that joint you all started living in and hanging around down there?
Upstage Club.
Yeah, well,
the Upstage Club was the main, you know, that's what I mean. That was, you're there from 8 o'clock at night till 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
For kids.
Right.
You know, this is for no booze.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, there's nothing
so you
like
could
that
play
now.
All night.
Yeah.
Yeah. And didn't
I meet people?
Were you all living at a guy who made surfboards?
Well, that was a little later. Yeah, he Bruce lived in a surfboard factory off and on.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that was good for the lungs.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, you didn't live there too?
No, I stayed there a few times, but I was like, this is not for me. then me and Bruce moved to an apartment in Asbury, and then we had another apartment where me and Southside Johnny and others lived together. So, you know, we're kind of living together more or less at that
But
same
it was
time.
That it was that kids club, the Upstage.
Yeah, that was like the place where everybody met. Where we met Southside Johnny, where we met you know, like Vinnie Lopez and Danny Federici and Gary Talent, and all of those guys were living either in Asbury or Neptune, or you know.
Yeah.
So we were kind of like the Jersey Shore guys who came down. So I quit playing at some point, like 72. I was like, man, we missed it. We missed the boat. All the great stuff's done.
Oh, yeah. It's over.
Yeah, it's over.
Yeah.
So I started working construction on the highway, and I'm playing football on the weekend, and I broke my finger.
Ugh.
Still bent.
Yeah.
And to exercise my finger, I joined this band playing piano.
Yeah.
And that band ended up becoming the backup group for the Dovells on what was called the Oldie Circuit.
Right.
Now, the Oldie Circuit was a ironic and tragic sort of thing because the British invasion came over and basically put all their heroes out of work. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. In their
30s. But also introduced this country to the blues.
Well, it did both. It introduced us to all of their heroes, which we all learned about, and then put them all out of work at the same time.
Right. A lot of them had like two or three hits, right?
That was it. And if you had two or three hits, you had two or three hits for the rest of your life.
Right.
No more recording.
That was it.
It was sad.
It's sad, you know.
So they're all pissed off being called oldies, and they're in their 30s and early 40s, right?
And they're touring together, right, on a bus, five or six of them.
Yeah. The Richard Nader oldies circuit,
right?
You know, which you know, I played the Garden for the first time with that.
Oh yeah, with who?
You know, everybody.
Oh yeah. Oh, you were just a backing band.
12 acts. Oh no, I was with Dovells.
Yeah,
and then later with Dion.
Oh, Dion.
But you know, in those days, you know, you had Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley. I mean, everybody was on the show.
Oh yeah, so you were there.
Yeah, I wasn't playing with them all,
but you were hanging out
on the same show.
Nice.
It was nice for me because I'm meeting all these cool people, but they're all pissed off. You know.
You felt the bitterness.
Sure. Yeah.
Because that's where they were stuck there to make a living.
Yes, there was so suddenly they had their lives taken away, as opposed to the very next generation, starting with the second generation, starting with the Beatles and Stones and second generation. The fans would go with them forever, all the way to stadiums, and are still with them.
Yeah,
still right now the biggest acts are McCartney and the Stones.
And those kids are now 70.
Yeah. But why did that first generation get shafted? I will never know. It's just one of them crazy things, but. Anyway, so I'm on that circuit, and I said to myself, I've been writing songs 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it was by then.
Yeah.
And I just hated everything I was doing. So I said, let me go to school in my head.
Yeah.
Okay. So where does it start? And I'm thinking about it. You know, looking back in history, I said, okay, it starts with Lieber and Stoller, right?
Yeah.
Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller to me is the beginning of songwriting in that sense. You know, that became. The songwriting that we know, you know.
So and Doc Pumice too, or Doc?
Well, all Pumice and Schumann and you know, the Brill Building and you know, all that, you know.
Right.
But for me, you know, I just picked out Lieber and Stoller for me, you know.
Which song was your Lieber and Stoller song?
Well, I dug everything back to Hound Dog with Big Mama Thornton. And you know, I mean, Kansas City was no slouch. Jailhouse Rock. You know, Stand
Those
By Me.
Those are their songs?
Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah, Ruby Baby. Forget It. You know.
The best.
These guys are like, you know, the killers, right? Yeah. So I said, okay, I'm going to write a Lieber and Stoller song for the Drifters. In my head, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wrote I Don't Want to Go Home. And that was the first song I felt like, okay, that's a real song. You know what I mean? That makes sense to me in a historical sense, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I met Benny King, but I didn't have the courage really to give it to him. And at that point, I wouldn't have known what to do with it anyway. So I ended up giving it to Southside Johnny, and that became the first record. But that was the beginning of songwriting.
And that was the Drifter song.
Yeah.
That's wild.
So I recut it for this new album. In the original way I pictured it, which was the lead singer answered by the background vocals.
Right, on the one I just listened to?
Yeah.
Oh, I got to listen to it more closely.
Yeah, it's a Persuasion. Yeah. I used the Persuasions on the record.
Yeah. Oh, okay, great.
Yeah. So that was, you know.
I know you did that, that Blues Is My Business.
I actually did a couple of covers, which I've never done before, which was so much fun, you know.
And Business Is Good. That's great.
That's a great line, right?
Yeah, it's great.
I know, I wish I wrote it. Blues Is My Business, and you know, I'm open for business in your neighborhood. Blues Is My Business, and Business Is Good, you know. I was like, yeah. That's what this about says it.
Yeah.
It's an Etta James song I covered, and I covered a James Brown song also on this album, which is the first two covers I've ever done, you know, in my life.
Really?
Yeah, so it was a nice kind
recorded,
of opportunity.
That you record, right.
Yeah, you know, cause by the time you get into business, you know, you get your own thing going, and you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, so this was a nice opportunity to introduce myself and including some roots, you know?
A lover of songs.
Yeah, so I put blues on here, I put a doo-wop song on there, you know, things that, you know, really where I'm coming from. And
Production's real crisp, real good.
Yeah, thank you.
Pops,
man. Yeah, man, that's, you know, me and I got a great engineer, Jeff Sanoff, and Bobby Clearmountain mixing it. So, he's good for me because I got a lot going on, you know, and he keeps, I like a wall of clarity, you know what I mean? I want you to hear what everybody's playing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, not too much separation,
you
know, so I got a weird kind of philosophy with music that, you know, Bobby really seems to understand. And,
which is the wall of clarity?
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't want too much separation because I you know, stereo was the beginning of the end for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I don't need stereo. I don't need digital. You can just wipe all that stuff out, okay?
Yeah.
And I would be just fine, you know? But, you know, I want that sound when you walk into a room and a band's playing. So you can pick out everybody's playing,
yeah.
But it's not it's integrated. It's not.
I can feel that. You know, now that you say that, I like you open the door. It's like, wow.
Exactly.
And then you're like, oh, that's that guy. and then it kind of all comes together when you want it to, or you can focus on that guy.
That's right. Yeah. As opposed to what Phil was doing, which was genius, but you know, he was intentionally combining things so you don't really know what's going on. You know what I mean? He's got 50, 60 things going on.
Yeah.
And you're not hearing them
it's,
all.
It's a know? Very elaborate white noise.
Yes. You know, but he picks out the important sure, parts you're going to sure. hear. You know,
the tambourine.
He makes sure to riff. He makes sure you hear the riffs. It's a slightly different concept from that, but it comes from Lieber and Stoller's productions. It comes from Motown, comes from Phil Spector a little bit, and you know, the Curtis Mayfield records, you know, with the Impressions, and then after, even his solo stuff.
You can hear all that stuff on this record.
Yeah, and Alan Toussaint in New Orleans, you know.
I just got a few of his solo records. I've been getting into the vinyl thing lately, and for me, all this stuff is new. Things are always new to me. Because I never heard it before. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you grow up, you hear the hits, you hear the music that you brought up with, and now I'm 54, and I'm every day it's like I never listened to this. It never ends.
No, it's a lot of stuff, man. It's a lot of stuff. I mean, when I started the radio show, I'm like, okay, I got to go back and listen to every record ever made because I don't want to miss anything.
Good luck.
And I'm still working on it.
And
it's
sort of amazing.
Like 15 years later, I'm still like, damn, I never heard.
I just listened to 10 Years After his first record, for the first time. I don't know. You know, it was all right. there's a few things that get better. Some things get better later.
Yeah.
So you're getting this education with these cats. So, you know, when do you and Bruce sit down and start hammering this shit out?
Well, I came back from that oldie circuit and started Southside Johnny Adbury Jukes, you know, and then...
That was your band.
Me and Johnny. Is he still around? They're still doing very well.
Great.
Yeah. And then we found this club called the Stone Pony, which the roof had caved in, and they were going to close. This is like, I'm picturing it, I may be completely making this up, but I picture it being like July... And they wanted to stay open like one more month to get the summer crowd.
Yeah.
And then they're going to close the place.
Right.
Because it had been a hurricane.
Yeah.
And the roof kind of had caved in.
Yeah.
And so we went to them. And for the first time in history, we said to them, listen, we'll play for the door.
Yeah.
We'll keep the bar. But we're going to play whatever we want. Now, no one ever had done that before. Nobody in New Jersey.
Yeah.
You'll have to play the top 40.
Right.
What they call the top 40
so
back then.
So the kids can understand what's happening.
Yeah, and dance. It was all about dancing back then. People were dancing to rock and roll, keep in mind, right?
Right, yeah.
You know, nobody's seen anybody dance to rock and roll in 50 years. But back then, you danced to rock and roll, and your job, you were a dance band. You got them dancing or you didn't work, you know?
Yeah.
And that was the same thing. I'm sure that was true for the Beatles in Hamburg and even the Stones, you know?
Yeah.
In Richmond, you know? At the Crawdaddy Club, you know? It was important that people danced, you know, in those days. Anyway, so we got a chance to play whatever we wanted to, and I was just starting to write, like I said, we snuck in, I Don't Want to Go Home, and said it was a Drifter song,
I didn't say
it was an original,
but
we started playing all kinds of different things, Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, album tracks, you know, from those guys.
This is with the Jukes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Temptations, album tracks, and, you know, we introduced reggae, Harder They Come had just come out.
And obviously you're doing it with your sensibility, because you guys are interpreting this music.
Yes, yes. So we had that right away. We started to have a horn section, and so it started to be a combination of rock and soul right away. You know? And figured that was going to be our thing, you know.
And it just happened organically.
Yeah. So we did that for a year or two, and I was not only leading the band, you know, but also... you know, managing it and doing all the business and working with those club owners, they're all a pain in the ass.
Sure.
So after a year or two of that, so Bruce starts hanging out because his first two records did nothing and they're about to drop them.
Asbury Park and East Street Shuffle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they did, 10,000 records.
When you guys saw, when he got the deal, was everyone in the neighborhood like, here he goes, one of our guys?
Yeah. It was thrilling, that he got signed. But the you know, he's making nothing.
Yeah.
In the music business.
Sure.
We got 1,000 people a night. Yeah. Three nights a week, yeah. You know? I mean, you know, I haven't made that much money since, you know what I mean? I mean, it was like my entire overhead was $150, you know,
yeah,
for my apartment, you know, and we're making, you know, like, you know, $9,000 a week. So Bruce starts hanging out with us.
Yeah.
And he had a little notoriety because he was signed.
Was he depressed?
No.
No.
He was always very philosophical about it. I mean, uh-huh. I'm sure he wasn't thrilled about it.
Right.
But at the same time, he wasn't going nowhere.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we were doing what we did. Like I said, for us, it became a lifestyle now.
Yeah.
It was not, we didn't have that show business.
Right, right.
You know, that desperation. Yeah.
Right.
That show business desperation in our heads. We were like, hey, we're doing this, whether we're getting paid or not, or whether we're famous or not, you know. So
we're in it.
We're in it, man, because we ain't belong anywhere else.
Yeah.
We're complete misfits, outcasts, you know, freaks, right?
Yeah.
We weren't going to
go. No jobs.
No, there was no job that was, you know, that was right for us.
No plan B, man.
No.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's how you,
that's the only way.
That's the only way, man, because everybody who had an option in our neighborhood
took it. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And there's me and Bruce, you know, stand last guy standing, man.
You
know?
Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, we.
So he's hanging around.
So yeah, so he's hanging around, and then so he puts out a third album, Born to Run, and he's got like 7 gigs booked, and that's it. And like the 7th gig is a bottom line, which is like a showcase. It's like kind of like the Roxy was.
He put out here. Born to Run. You're not on Born to Run.
No.
Not at all.
No. No. That's just coming out, and he has 7 gigs booked, and that was going to be like, you know, curtains, man, you know, if something magical didn't happen. So he says, listen, I want to put the guitar down for a minute, you know, and just front. So come play these last 7 shows of mine, you know? So I was anxious to get out of town. I was tired of fighting with the club owners all the time. We had to threaten to go across the street, to go from 5 sets a night to 3, which we had done.
Right.
Right, which was, again, made history in New Jersey because, you know, you had to play 5 sets a night.
Yeah.
We got it down to 3, which I thought was a major victory, but it was still a war every week, you know.
Yeah.
And they're always trying to fuck you one way or the other, you know.
Sure.
And so I said, you know what, let me get out of town, I'll, you know, fine.
Right.
So I left for 7 shows, and I stayed 7 years, you know.
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
Good time?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. It was. It was. It was fun. That same, right after that, so 7 shows, that bottom line thing was so successful, we then came to L.A. for the first time and played the Roxy.
Oh, yeah. The trip to L.A.
And that was really exciting because, you know, you look down from the stage, you know, there's Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty and... You know, and you know, whoever, you know, Cher, and you know, it's like, you know, I was like, wow, you know, we had never seen any celebrities before, you know,
right,
you know, like, I guess, you know, celebrities in New Jersey, you know, unless they were mob celebrities, you know, so, like, you know. But you know, so that was really, really very exciting.
And you went over to England with him, right?
Yeah, yeah, that
the
was
big
freaky.
Hammersmith, but that was a hell of a show, right?
Yeah, we did 4 shows, 2 in England,
because,
1.
Because like it feels to me that like the Americans weren't locking in as quickly as it happened over there.
Well, yeah, but there was no reason for us to really go other than Frank Barcelona, our genius agent, kept insisting on us going over there, and thank God we did, because now we are, you know, very, very successful over there. But it was not a typical thing Americans did. No, you know, it wasn't so much to the audience, but the people just didn't bother to go over there, you know. And
do we have to?
You know, yeah. It was like that. Meanwhile, you know, we are now, it's like saving everybody's lives, those who did go, you know, very happy they did. But what was remarkable about that first trip to England is for no reason at all, somebody filmed it and recorded it, you know? And I mean, we were nothing. We were absolutely, you know, there wasn't even any hype or anything. It was, you know.
It was around that same 7, it was around that first tour, right?
Yeah,
like
third album.
After Born to Run,
The Born to Run tour, yeah. And so when Bruce later, when he was thinking about a re-release, you know, whatever, 20, 30 years later, you know, fairly recently,
yeah.
And he's looking in the archives, and he saw, you know, he saw a video. He said, "Oh, maybe somebody took a little, you know, a couple of minutes of a song."
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He pulled it out. It's an entire show, and recorded like 24 track. I mean, for no reason whatsoever.
You didn't even
know
it was happening.
No, we didn't know it was happening. We didn't know why it was happening. Why would anybody have done it? We were nothing. We meant nothing. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was just a wonderful little. You know, thing, because we're right in
time
between.
Capsule.
Yeah, we're right in between being a club band and an arena band, right?
Yeah.
And so you capture that wonderful transitional moment. And it's also very freaky. The lighting is very freaky because Mark Brickman, our light guy, that was the first time we ever played a theater.
Yeah.
Now, in theaters, the spotlights are in the balcony, right?
Yeah.
So we're doing a sound check.
Follow spots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're right in your eyes.
Yes,
so for the first time.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, is that necessary? You know, and Bruce is like, yeah, that's bugging me too. So we made Mark Brickman shut off the spotlights.
Yeah.
So if you look at that film, which is in the Born to Run re-release, it's very freaky. It's all backlit.
Yeah.
So Bruce will come up to the mic to sing, and you don't see his face.
You see an outline?
You just see like an outline of him, kind of, you know, which is really kind of cool. You'll never see that again.
Because, right.
You know, obviously anybody else would have had a spotlight.
Because you wanted to see the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Very important.
The spotlight will blow you out.
And still is.
Yeah.
I still make them turn it down.
Yeah.
You know?
Because, like, you don't want to feel like you're just floating in space.
I hate that feeling.
It's weird.
That's why I can't use the monitors.
Yeah, the monitors,
you know? Same reason, you know?
You need to be in it. Are your ears holding up all right?
Yeah, not bad.
Yeah.
You know.
So Darkness is the first one you did, pretty much, with him?
Yeah.
And like, because, like, I tell you, man, like, going over, like, some of your stuff and just, you know, and also listening to a lot of the stuff, because I talked to him. It seems like you guys, you were either on very much the same page or you influenced each other.
I think both.
Yeah?
Both. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt. We were strengthening each other because, you know, there was nobody else. You know what I mean? It was religion to us. So we were deep in it.
Yeah.
You know, and also listening to very much the same things back then. And,
yeah. And also, you know, you're hanging out. So he's watching you in Southside. I mean, he knows the Jersey sound that's evolving. He's part of it.
Yeah.
Clarence comes in at some point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that was all our respective tradition.
Yeah.
Which was just in our DNA. I don't know why, you know, but it was in our DNA. You know, the next, you know, if you were born a year or two later, maybe it wouldn't have been, you know, but we were still, what happened to that great 60s thing? You know, we were still very much addicted to that, what I call the Renaissance period. You know, that Renaissance period was so influential to us, and we wanted to continue it somehow. You know,
yeah, the structure is a little different. Like it's rock and roll, but that soul structure, the minor chords, and the sort of like the storytelling. It's not, you know, it wasn't mainstream at that point.
Right, it never was. It never was.
Really,
we by the time our hybrid began, whether it was my hybrid or Bruce's hybrid. Neither one was fashionable. Neither one was trendy. It was completely against what was going on.
That's interesting, though, because, you know, like those first two Bruce records, like, you know, Asbury Park, you know, is almost a Van Morrison record, you know, in some ways, right? And E Street Shuffle started to evolve, and then the Born to Run, that tune, boom, like the Spectre thing, and then by the time you guys do Darkness,
yeah,
then it's like, that's it. Darkness is where it happens in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, I would say Born to Run was the beginning of a break that was dramatic. You know what I mean? His songwriting and everything took a focus that was a bit more, it was just another evolution that was really a noticeable evolution at that point, you know, from a local kind of, you know, singer-songwriter.
Right.
To a more formalized, okay, this is rock and roll. This is
production.
You know,
Yeah. I thought you were on Born to Run. You didn't do nothing?
Nope.
Didn't help out at all?
Nope. Yeah, I did a little bit of the horns on 10th Avenue, you know. Arrange the horns a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
That's about it, really.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You were around, though?
Yeah. I was there, you know. I was hanging around. But by then, the Jukes had started. You know, we were doing the Jukes by then.
Right,
So,
And on Darkness, like, you know, like the one thing, like talking to him that, like, I didn't realize till after the fact, right? Because, I mean, you guys, you produced a couple records with him, like, right?
Yeah, the River and Born USA. Yeah.
is that, you know, and I don't know why I didn't put it together, because I watched that Iovine, the Jimmy Iovine, the doc, that, but that was Born to Run. That was making that, right?
Yeah, Jimmy was the engineer on Born to Run, yep.
But no matter what he did, and I was mad that I didn't recognize it, he's very hard on himself, Bruce is, it seems.
Well, back then, it was you know, it was a very tough period. I mean, Born to Run, into it's right through darkness was... Bruce struggling to find himself and where he wanted to go, and you know, fighting the realities of the business and fighting with his manager at the time, and the lawsuit, and
right,
trying to regain control of his publishing, which he had lost temporarily. You know, suddenly things were spinning out of control. He's on the cover of Time and Newsweek, which he didn't really want to be.
Right.
He didn't want to be considered hype. You know, he wanted to be the real thing, right?
Yeah.
So he's kind of in a hurricane of distractions.
Sure.
And you know, so the records took a lot of time and took a lot of blood, you know.
But also, I imagine the way you're describing it, probably a nice escape, like to be in the studio and to have that
No, that didn't happen until I produced the record. The River was the opposite, because We go through this darkness thing, you know, and I'm helping with the arrangements at that point, but I'm not a producer yet, you know, and we start to do The River, and I said to him, I said, listen, man, I can't go through this again, okay? I'm sorry. I can't watch you go through this. It's nothing to do with me.
What's the all-night kind of nitpicking? And
forget it. You know, months and months and months of just torture. You know, torture.
Yeah.
I said to him, I said, listen, man, I don't want to see you go through this again, you know, so I'm just going to split, you know. And he says, no. You're gonna make this record with me. You're going to produce this record with me. I said, for real? He says, absolutely. So I get us into the power station and Bob Clearmountain, who I had checked out, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of a camouflage, but basically I had to try and get where I felt we needed to go. And suddenly
with Bruce,
we were in the right place suddenly. Yeah. Suddenly we found the right room.
Yeah.
And the right sound. And now it's a pleasure to go in and record. Okay, finally. You know what I mean? It was like
he trusted that. You.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. But he, you know, he could hear it. Everybody could hear it. You know, and John Landau was right there. You know, he wasn't, you know, nobody was objecting to it. It was just finally finding the right room. But I had done a whole lot of research by then, trying to figure out why the drums sound great on every 50s and 60s record and sound terrible in the 70s, you know?
Yeah.
You know, why? What's going on, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I figured it out. It was the way they were mic'd, you know? In the old days, they were mic'd but overhead.
Right.
You know? And then suddenly the 70s began close mic'ing.
Stick a mic in the bass drum.
Yeah, the engineers took over temporarily.
So a set had like 9 mics.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that as much as the close miking, you know, so they could have extreme separation and control.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, extreme separation and control, not exactly rock and roll, good for rock and roll, really.
Yeah.
So you want to have the overheads, you know, and you still want to have some separate miking to control to some extent. But you know, so it was that combined with the tuning. I realized all of the early guys, all the early drummers were trained by jazz drummers, and they learned how to tune the drums. Plus, they're playing with their wrist up.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And playing lighter.
Yeah.
And what I discovered was the lighter you hit a well-tuned snare drum, the lighter you hit it, the bigger it sounds.
No shit.
Okay?
Yeah.
If you hit it, you know, like you're, you know, hitting like a caveman.
Yeah.
Right?
Bonham style.
It it blows out the snares. The snares do not resonate.
Oh, right. I'll get it. Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's just like
thuds.
Boom, thud. It's a thud.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, right? Basically. So I'm discovering all this stuff now and anxious to put it to work, you know, which we did.
Yeah.
And we, you know.
And it came with The River.
Yeah.
What a vast, like, elaborate musical landscape that was, huh?
Yeah, man, yeah, because it was all building up inside him. And he actually had started writing like a demon on darkness. I mean, Born to Run, I think he wrote eight and a half songs, and like, you know, eight of them were on the record.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean,
right.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a ninth song, right?
That was it.
Darkness, he writes 60 songs.
No shit.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We need 10.
Yeah.
And you know, and you could tell from these outtakes, there, you know, a lot of really good stuff. So he starts during that Darkness and River. I don't know. I never counted them, but it's probably 100 or 120 songs.
Did you record them all?
Yeah.
No shit.
And at this point, a lot of them are out. Most
on
of them
tracks?
Are out. Yeah, tracks. The Darkness re-release.
Yeah.
The River re-release.
Uh-huh.
This whole, they all accompany with an outtake album.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's great stuff. Not good. Not like, oh, it wasn't good enough to be on the record.
Yeah.
This stuff should have been its own album.
Right.
That's how good it was.
I wonder why he didn't do that.
Well, he was, you know, again, being very, very hard on himself in terms of the identity and, you know, and that's what he needed to do at the time.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, he realizes now, because he thought some of the stuff was too obviously influenced by this or that. You know, wasn't enough him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Oh, interesting.
But he was quite wrong about that, because if you listen to it now, it's very obvious. It just all sounds like him.
Yeah, definitely.
And yes, there's some influence in there. So what?
Yeah.
You know?
Everyone's influenced.
So, but, you know, he had to do what he had to do, you know. And, you know.
And Born in the USA, you did too?
Born USA, I did. That was we got to the point at that point where we said, like, let's take it to the next level and not rehearse at all.
Huh.
We went in the studio. He taught us a song once.
Yeah.
Right. We had a couple of arrangement things maybe here and there, and then we would cut it. And then if you wanted to sing it again, we played it again. So on the eight or nine things I did on Born USA,
yeah,
there's nothing, no overdubs,
huh.
Zero.
Huh. You know? You just repeat the whole take.
Yep.
As a band.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was no reason. I mean, it's just a silly thing to do, but we decided to do it.
But it made a difference. It had to make a difference.
I don't know. I mean, looking back on it now, it's just kind of a silly thing to do, really. But we just wanted to maybe prove to ourselves that we could, you know. We wanted to, you know, I mean, the River was a turning point where we finally captured what the band sounded like on a record.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Darkness to me was a tragedy. You know, I thought it was some of his best songs, you know, some of his classic songs. I hated the way that thing sounded.
You did?
Yeah.
Why did that happen?
Because we didn't know what we were doing, you know? You know, rock and roll is not one craft. We think it's one craft.
Right.
It's five crafts.
Yeah.
Okay? Right? You learned your instrument. Okay?
Yeah.
You learn to analyze records and see what's going on those records, which is the beginning of learning how to arrange records.
Right.
You perform, learn how to perform.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's a very important step that people are skipping these days,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you need to learn how to interact with an audience, how to interact with your band, see how them songs affect people. And most importantly, because you've analyzed the records and you're performing cover songs, you now have established standards.
Mm-hmm.
You have these very high standards, which comes in handy for the fourth craft, which is writing, right?
Right.
You go to write a song. Well, now you got to write something that's in the ballpark of what you've been playing live, right?
Yeah.
Which is your favorite song, okay?
Yeah.
You have something called standards, right?
Yeah.
If you skip that stage, you don't have standards,
right?
Which is what's going on now,
uh-huh.
right? And then the fifth craft is recording.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you know, it took us whatever, four, you know, what was that, three, four, five albums?
To get it.
Did
you ever think about later going back and re-recording the Darkness stuff?
I begged him to let me at least remix it. Can I please remix it? He said, what, are you nuts? He says, people gotten used to this thing by now. You know, it never bothered him, in fairness. It never bothered him.
Uh-huh.
It never bothered anybody, really,
right,
but
right.
me. You know, I was like, man. I did, you know, this thing could be so much better. So much better, you know. But, yeah.
No remix.
He wouldn't let me mess with it. No.
That's hilarious.
No.
So, because I listened to the demo of Born in the USA on tracks, the sort of like haunting song, Born in the USA. How did it shift from that to the anthem?
Well, he was messing around at that point with some acoustic things, some electric. I mean, that was where you know, Nebraska came out of that period too,
right?
You know, so you know,
reverby acoustic.
Yeah, that's just like acoustic stuff that he was fooling around with, because he always had that in him, that part of him that was that folk guy,
you
know,
sure.
You know, that's the one thing you know, we're most different, probably. You know,
yeah.
You don't got that in there. No, but I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I was the first one to recognize that Nebraska should be released. You know, it was to me it was he did it as a demo, and I was like, this ain't no demo, man.
Oh, so Born in the USA was originally on those demos?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
You know,
it does sound like that. It's a really haunting that one.
It was in that same period. Yeah, you know, yeah. So you know, but whatever.
And yeah, then you kind of, you know, you toured with him for a while and then you went your way?
Yeah, I split, man. I produced, you know, most of Born USA and then split. And then I made two solo albums while they were still working
fighting
on Born USA.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I got obsessed with politics and got into, you know, just trying to, you know, shed some light on things I felt needed to, you know.
Yeah, and you're producing some other stuff too for Asbury, for Southside Johnny.
Yeah, I did three Southside records.
Gary U.S. Bonds.
Well, yeah, Bruce started that and then brought me into that. We did two albums with Gary Bonds. And then, I would start producing other people after that. But mostly friends. You know what I mean? I never did it as a living, as a job, exactly, you know.
So when you get the call, who got the call for The Rising? You know, like, how did that come together?
We had the reunion by then, right?
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
it was 2000 and
yeah, he just decided, he had like 99 or.
Yeah.
He just decided, you know, let's put the band back together. And we had been talking about it, you know, through the years, you know. We stayed friendly all those years. And I just said, you know, maybe it's time because. You know, you look at these polls that come out every year, you know, greatest bands of all time, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was watching, you know, you start off as like, you know, number one or so, you know, then you're like 2, 3, 5, 10.
You're slipping, huh?
And then, you know, by the 7th or 8th or 10th year, you know, you're like basically off the charts, you know? I was like, you know, maybe it's time to come back and remind people that, you know.
We're the best band in the
world. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, it was certainly one of them. And we're no longer in the top 10, okay? So I think it's time maybe to come back and remind people, like, what it's really all about.
So you guys were already a band when the horrible thing happened. And then you guys, you know, because I remember that time after 9/11 where, you know, like there was this weird kind of like, well, when's, you know, Bruce going to chime in? You know, and then that record, like, what was the process of making that thing?
Yeah, well, that was Brendan O'Brien.
Yeah,
he had brought in a new producer,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
who did two or three albums, I think. And it was this sort of a different method. It was a whole different methodology. Bruce started to do demos in his house, and then have the band kind of, you know.
Pop in?
Yeah, you know, like replace his stuff. And you know what I mean?
Oh, interesting.
It's a whole different,
yeah,
different
as methodology. Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to the old way, which was working the songs up with the band, you know.
Right, right.
You know, we were always very, very, we made a lot of contributions in the old days, you know.
Yeah.
To the arrangements and stuff like that. This was, you know, it was a transitional thing to get back from being a solo guy back into being a band guy, which.
Interesting.
It's a tough transition to make, you know what I mean? And, you know. He has both things in him, but it took a minute to you know, get comfortable with that again, I'm sure, you know?
But you guys are still tight?
Yeah, oh, yeah, very.
Yeah.
Very. He came out to support my first couple solo shows.
Yeah, did he get up there and play?
Yeah. And I just made sure I supported him on his opening in Broadway. And
how was that?
Great.
Was he tell some stories
really
and play
great.
Some songs? How's it work?
It's different than you'd think. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of a surprise because it's quite a different medium, you know. And he has again redefined himself in that medium. You know what I mean?
Well, I just talked to him last year, you know, and was very thoughtful, and obviously the book he, you know, kind of revealed a lot about himself. He's an intense guy. So,
yeah.
So what is the elements of the show? You can't get tickets anymore. So tell us, Steve.
Well, I get a feeling, I mean, he hasn't said anything to me about it, but I think after Broadway, I can't imagine him not taking it on the road a little bit.
Yeah.
So maybe he'll come to LA with it, but I don't know. I don't know that. Okay. That's not me giving any inside information. We didn't talk about it, but.
But it's that good.
If I was him, yeah, you know what I mean? I'm looking at what he's doing. You got to go to London. You got to go to, you know, maybe Stockholm or, you know, LA, Chicago.
Is there a story?
So he comes, yeah, he comes. I mean, it's book related, certainly, you know, but he comes out and, you know, what I was worried about, like, I went to a preview as well as the opening. And,
yeah.
I was hoping that the audience would respect the protocols of this medium. Okay, right. You know what I mean?
Behave themselves.
I honestly, God, yeah. I was in a little bit of a panic. Like, are they gonna start calling out songs?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, is it gonna be like, oh no?
Yeah.
And they were totally cool. You know,
well, there, a lot of them are grown-ups now, Stephen.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean you don't call out songs and start, you know, clapping along and doing things like it's not appropriate.
Oh, no
you
shit.
Know, you know what I mean? But he comes out and starts talks first before he plays anything. So it sets up this, okay, you know, it's a serious night. And and even though he's got some funny things in his raps, but you know, he establishes a sort of seriousness to the medium.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That everybody just adapted to immediately, which is wonderful. So you'll love it.
He's got hell of a presence, you know.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's a small theater. It's under 1,000 people.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. You're in Bruce's head for a little while.
Yeah, man, and that is a really it's an interesting place to be because you know again the book. Obviously revealed a lot.
Did you think he got it right in the book?
It was really well written. I mean, I was even surprised how you know.
Yeah.
Because it didn't have to be that good. You know what I mean? To be good. You know. I mean, I was like, wow, this is better than it needs to be.
Did it jog into your memory a little bit? Did he like pull things out where you're like, oh shit, that's right.
Yeah. Some of the early stuff in Asbury was fun to read about. You kind of go back to that feeling of. It's an odd liberation when you got nothing going on. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. You have
absolutely.
It's all ahead of you.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know what's ahead of you. That's the thing.
That's right.
You can't really truly enjoy it because you don't know what's ahead.
Yeah.
You know? But you're just there. You know, you're just there kind of living in the moment, and there's a certain liberation, you know, liberating feeling to that too.
So, what about the we talked a bit about this record, but the acting thing, you enjoyed that? Is that something you're going to do more of?
Yes, I loved it, and I'm going to do more of it.
I got,
I'm going to try and create my own show now.
Didn't you create one?
No, I took what I learned from Sopranos and took it into Lilyhammer.
Right.
I started, you know, that one craft became like five because I co-wrote it, I co-produced it, I directed the final episode. And did the score and the
for Lilyhammer
music supervision. Yeah, so I want to continue that. It's
play another mobster.
We'll see. Maybe people like me as a mobster. You know, you don't want to mess with the people too much. You know what I mean, I'm one of the very few people on earth. Okay, once an audience defines you, that's it. Okay, first of all, you're lucky if an audience defines you because that means they found you.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that's why it's very rare for somebody to go from one medium to another.
Yeah.
Because you know they define you as that. You know.
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky because they completely accepted me as an actor.
It was such an interesting. I just rewatched The Sopranos like a year ago, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Again, just watch it all the way
through. I gotta do that.
It's pretty great, you know, because like you forget that there are some episodes that are sort of like, well, that was an interesting one. Like not a lot happened.
No, you see, this is a mistake that they're making in TV right now.
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody thinks it's all about plot. You know, plot driven.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We can't remember three plots in the entire Sopranos, right?
No.
It's all about character, man.
Right.
It's character driven. Yeah. And that's what I'm trying to, you know, that's what my scripts are, you know, and that's what I'm trying to tell these TV people. I'm like, listen, man, you know, I'm sorry, but name me like five great TV shows out of the 100 that are on right now, and then you know, can't name them, you know?
And the thing about your character in The Sopranos was weird because, like, initially, you know, you're like, is this guy a clown? Is this a comedic guy? You're right? Because you kind of think that, like, at the beginning, like, because you were so quirky. But then all of a sudden, you're killing people, and you're like, oh, fuck.
They were very well-written characters.
Yeah.
They're quirky.
Yeah.
They're eccentric. They're not what you necessarily would think is a cliche of
a
gangster.
Did Jay think of you as funny?
Well, we had that in the character, yes.
Right.
But subtly, really, you know, this very cool guy who was in charge of keeping Tony Soprano alive, basically, and the only character on the show that did not want to be the boss, right?
Yeah.
Very comfortable in that role.
Oh, yeah, I remember when he had to be the boss for a minute. It was not good.
No, not comfortable. And and so, you know, we used a little bit of humor when he would vent. his frustration, like at a card game or at his daughter's soccer game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the humor. Let him go nuts when it doesn't really matter. But in life and death matters, he totally
showed up. Are you like that in real life? Do you feel like that you've been that way for Bruce or for other people in your life?
Well, yeah, I basically use my relationship with Bruce for Sopranos.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
As a grounding influence?
That's what it was. That relationship of being the guy behind the guy and you know, being there as an underboss, as a consigliere, you know, as an advisor, you know, as a friend, right? That was it. I mean, when I wrote the biography of my character, I'm like that. Him and Jimmy, you know, him and Tony Soprano, grew up together, you know, and had that relationship all along,
right?
You know, which helped me because that was the first time as an actor, so I was able to rely on that. What that dynamic was, I knew sometimes I had to be the only one bringing the bad news. Right. You know what I mean?
Because
I was the only one not afraid of him.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You know, the only one.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because we're lifelong friends.
Yeah.
Right? So when you're the only one not afraid of him, you're the one that's going to be the bad news because everybody else is too afraid to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or think they're going to get their head chopped off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, where I could say, listen, you know, Tony, you know, Silvio could go to Tony and say, you know, and then we had some scenes like that.
And you had that kind of situations with Bruce. Maybe not as dire, but, you know.
But, yes. Yeah. You know, those moments have happened. And, you know, and you take the heat, man. It becomes a confrontation of, you know, who wants to hear bad news, right? You blame the messenger, right?
They know you well enough to wait it out. You know, you're going to take it, but then you'd be like, you're all right.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's how it is. You know, you survive it. You survive it.
And Gandolfini, what a great job he did. So sad that we lost that guy.
Major loss.
Oh my God.
Major loss.
A few lately, right? Petty's gone. Jesus.
Oh, that hit me very hard. You know, I mean, we've been opening every show with a Tom Petty song ever since. You know, because it's just very, very, you know,
special guy.
Very similar. You know.
I think so.
Yeah, we grew up the same way, you know, same influences, and
The space that you know, both your band or the E Street Band and Petty's band hold in the American, you know, culture, you know, in the American songbook, I've always found to be similar.
Yeah, it is. It's that you know, true classic rock of the '70s that was coming straight from the '60s, man. You know, with all the respect. So.
What songs you been doing?
But I've been opening with Even the Losers, you know.
Oh,
great
writer, huh?
Yeah, man.
And I'll tell you, man, I love this new record. I really do. It does exactly what you said. Thanks for describing it that way. That moment where you walk into the bar or the club and you hear the band. That's exactly it.
And I also felt like I said, people need a little sanctuary right now from the politics. And I mean, in the old days, I would bring the politics with me on tour. You know, okay, here comes a confrontation with politics that everybody needs to hear and needs to respond to, think about, and do something about, right? Mm-hmm. And now I'm exactly the opposite. I'm bringing like a bit of sanctuary for 2 hours. You know,
a little rock and roll.
Well, it's just a very musical show with this band. You know, it's a very, very, you know, 15 pieces. We're covering 10, 11 different subgenres of music. It's really the history of rock and roll.
Oh, great.
From doo-wop and blues to rock and soul to reggae and salsa, hard rock, folk rock. It's all in the show, you know? So it's a real transportation. You know, we're transporting people to a musical place that I think is very, I think, nourishing. You know, I think it's spiritually nourishing right now, which I think we need more than just more political
yelling.
I mean, you know, we're getting enough 24/7, man.
Yeah,
you know
get the human spirit thing going.
Really, that's where I think that's the purpose now. You know, I'm sticking around. I mean, I'm gonna keep making records now and keep touring and find a way to tour.
Yeah.
And then you know, me and you know, we'll go every other summer with the E Street Band or whatever.
Yeah.
And hopefully do a new TV show in the winter. So.
Wow, busy guy, and it was great talking to you. Look well. I'm glad you're healthy and the record's beautiful, and it was great meeting you.
Thanks, man. You too.
Well, that was a fine conversation with Mr. Steven Van Zandt. I wanted to mention, though, that he called me after the interview and said that he didn't finish a thought about fixing the Republican Party. He set it up, but he didn't finish it. And this is what he said to me. The way you do it is voting them out in 2018 on a state, local, and federal level. So he wanted me to add that. He didn't want to leave that hanging.
All right, I mentioned the book. Go pick up the book, Waiting for the Punch, Words to Live By, from the WTF podcast for last minute gift idea. That's it. That's it. And maybe I think I'm going to do some blues noodling, if you don't mind. That's what I feel like doing tonight. Very clean, very Stratocaster blues noodling. Little echo, maybe a little vibrato, but all from the built-in shit on the old Vibroverb. Thank you.